We're going to be studying the book of Hebrews starting this morning. And this morning, of course, we're just going to do an introduction to the book of Hebrews. Some things that I want to notice and cover. We're not going to go very in-depth by way of introductory material. Because the reality is to go in-depth into the book of Hebrews introductory material means either you're going to spend a whole lot of time talking about who wrote the book, or you're going to spend a whole lot of time actually covering in summary form what's in the book. So I just assume do a little bit of introduction and then get into the book. I do want to begin with a couple of statements, though, concerning the authorship, simply because it's something that often comes up by way of discussion and sometimes disagreement as to who wrote the book of Hebrews. Something to remember is that many of the books that are not signed, that is, for instance, when you look at the books of Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, Paul begins, Paul, the servant of Jesus Christ. Okay, he's identifying the authorship. And when he does so, you can know, because it's there by inspiration, you can know that Paul was the one who wrote it. Paul, the apostle of Jesus Christ. All right, so you know it's Paul, the apostle. Not even all books of the New Testament have that. For instance, the book of John. The book of John does not state who the writer is. Now, it's significant to note with the book of John that every time John, the apostle, is referenced, or almost every time, he's referenced as the one who Jesus loved, instead of referencing himself by name, which gives us a clue as to the author of the book of John, and tradition has held all the way from the earliest manuscripts and the earliest churches and the earliest records we have that John the Apostle was the one who wrote it. Okay? So there's some books that we have definite knowledge about the author because the author signed their name to the book. There's some books that we're so sure about the author that there's basically no disagreement at all. And then in the New Testament, there's the book of Hebrews. When it comes to the book of Hebrews, there is no author's name attached to it. And there has been disagreement going all the way back to about the second century as to who wrote it. And so just a couple of thoughts, a couple of notes concerning that. The author, and what we want to notice is what we can know about the author. And then we can maybe jump to some conclusions or some opinions about actually who wrote it. First and foremost, we can know that the author of the epistle was a Jew. He was one who was an Israelite by way of descendant. The manner in which he addresses his readers, evidently themselves Jews, is such as to forbid the supposition that he was a Gentile. The intimate knowledge of the way the Jewish system worked, the statements that are made throughout the book that indicate that he was one who had been under this system, who had lived under the old law of Moses, all indicate that he was a Jew. So that narrows out, for instance, Luke, who by all indications was a Gentile. He was, by all indications, a Greek. And so it at least narrows out a couple of options in the first century church, though certainly not very many. Second thing we know about him is that the author habitually used the LXX. And if you know what the LXX is, that's the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. That was the translation that was done in about 250 BC by individuals in Alexandria of the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, as you go through the New Testament, it's interesting to note that the quotations from the Old Testament aren't always from the same sets of manuscripts, in the sense that sometimes the people who are quoting passages from the Old Testament quote from the Hebrew. They quote from the original language, though they're quoting in Greek. Sometimes, though, they quote from the Septuagint. They quote from the Greek because it was the Bible used and held in high esteem in Palestine in the first century AD. The Jews in the first century, when Jesus lived, when the apostles were there in Palestine and in Israel, did not primarily use the Hebrew Scriptures. They used the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. And so you find in the book of Hebrews something rather unique in that almost all of the quotations are from the Septuagint as opposed to the original Hebrew. And so that's just something significant to point out, that he was familiar with the church in the area of Palestine that significantly and predominantly used the Septuagint version. Number three, there is much in the book of Hebrews that reminds us of Paul. Because as you look at the epistles of Paul, you look at Ephesians, you look at Romans, you look at all of his epistles, they are very logical. They are series of arguments tied together and sometimes very deep and intrinsic arguments that lay out his conclusions. Notice as well that the author was connected to Timothy. Chapter 13, the end of the book, there is a greeting from Timothy. Now, it just states that it's Timothy. We only know of one recorded Timothy in the first century church, but that doesn't mean there was only one. So it could be a different Timothy and therefore have no implication of it being Paul. But it seems less likely that is the case. Note, too, that the close parallel to Paul's epistles in doctrine, circumstance, appeal to Scripture to demonstrate the truth of Christian doctrine, and similarity of phraseology, diction, style, etc. Between the epistles to the Hebrews and the 13 sign letters of Paul, there's so much comparative that you can do in the way the text is handled that it lends itself to be Paul as the writer. The writer, in addition to that, writes excellent Greek. One of the things about the book of Hebrew is it is one of the most well-written Greek manuscripts of the whole New Testament. It follows the grammar of the Greek almost exclusively. It is very meticulous. It is the Greek in if you would think of it this way, it's the Greek of a higher order by way of the language that it contains, and which is somewhat of an argument for Paul and somewhat of an argument against Paul. Paul was certainly capable of that, but he constantly referenced himself as being rude in speech, that he spoke plainly, that he didn't try to use the eloquentness that certainly was available, but at the same time, you know that he knows the difference. Because he was schooled in all of those things and was very well capable of presenting stuff that way, which is exactly his point in 1 and 2 Corinthians when he references that. He says, I could come to you this way. I could come to you and exhort you through eloquence of speech and through all of these things, but I'm not. I'm coming to you as one who is rude in speech, one who is simple, to declare to you the simple gospel. But with the book of Hebrews, it is a very eloquent book. Some have suggested maybe that the original person who was the writer of it gave it, and that the eloquence of the writing is a result of whoever was the amanuensis, the scribe that actually penned it down. And that maybe he was not a Jew, but instead a Gentile. Some have suggested Luke and others. Fifth, the author was not one of the original 12 apostles. Now, chapter 2, verse 3 gives us this indication. Chapter 2, verse 3 of the book of Hebrews. Who being made, I'm in chapter 1. Chapter 2, verse 3. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard him. The one who's writing the epistle includes himself in the group of those who had it confirmed to them by those who were present with Christ in person. Now, You go over the book of Galatians, and again, this is a passage that indicates maybe it is Paul, but maybe it wasn't Paul. Because Paul, in the book of Galatians, affirms that Christ delivered to himself, to Paul, that which he presented, and he didn't receive it from the apostles. He didn't go to Jerusalem after he was baptized in order to find out what to preach. Matter of fact, he spent 3 years at least out away from Jerusalem after having been converted before he ever went to Jerusalem and met with the other apostles. He had been preaching for a minimum of 3 years before he went to Jerusalem and met the other apostles. And yet he had already been declared an apostle by Jesus Christ. So it's interesting to note the contrast. If it is Paul, the indication is I wasn't present physically when Jesus was on the earth. If it isn't Paul, it could be an indication, well, maybe this isn't Paul because he said, Galatians, he got what he spoke from Christ, but here he's saying it was confirmed by those who heard him. So whether the individual's talking solely about the witness of the physical acts of Christ or the origination of the message dictates how you understand that. Notice number 6, the author was a male. As the masculine participle to tell, chapter 11, verse 32, plainly shows, had the writer been a female, the feminine particle would have been used. So, 6 things we know about the author of the book of Hebrews based on the text is that, number 1, he was a Jew. Number 2, he habitually used the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. Number 3, there's much in the book of Hebrews that reminds us of Paul, but his name isn't on it. Number 4, the writer writes excellent Greek. Number 5, the author was not one of the original 12 apostles. And number 6, the author was a male. That's what we know. Now, when you go back to testimony from the early church as to who was writing it, there's a division. Among the Eastern churches in the early 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century, there's a consensus, it's Paul. Among the Western churches, and some in the region of Africa, there's disagreement. Though they will all basically eventually, by the 3rd century, basically give in and say, yeah, it's probably Paul. So, earlier on, it depends on which geographical location as whether you thought it was Paul or you thought it was somebody else. And then over time, it kind of just shifts over into the general belief that it is Paul. Now, I'm not going to go into the testimony and the different things people wrote in the early centuries as to whether or not it is Paul. I will say this. It's my personal opinion, based upon reading and studying the comparison of the writing style, and the argument style, I think it's Paul. So if I occasionally say Paul writes Hebrews chapter 2 verse 4, it's just because that's my personal opinion, and so I'm not going to try and police myself the whole way through the book over the next however many weeks. If I say it, I say it. And if I don't, I don't. There you have it. What I want to do for the conclusion or the remainder of our time introducing the book is this. I want to look at what we learn about the readers of the book based upon the historical allusions in the book. Because here's where we have to be to understand the book of Hebrews. To understand the book of Hebrews, we have to be sitting in a church of the Lord in the first century as a Jew. Because that's who it's written to. And when we are able to understand the book from that perspective, when we're able to look through their glasses and through their lenses, through their eyes, to see what was written to them, then we'll understand it the way it was written. But if we try to just take it and put it in the first century or the 21st century or and in modern times and just ignore the original situation of the readers, then we do an injustice to the book. And we will not understand it from their perspective. And the perspective of the Jew in the first century who was a Christian was someone who had been a Jew under the law of Moses. And that's what the whole book is going to deal with from the point of argumentation. Is it is written to those who had been under the law of Moses. So we have to, as we go through the book, we have to understand the Old Testament. We have to understand the old law and all of the times it's going to be referenced continually through here to see the argument of the writer to the Jews in the first century who were Christians. So, number one, what we learn about the readers from the historical allusions. Number one, the readers were Christians. Let's notice some passages. Chapter 1, verse 3. Chapter 1, verse 3. Who being the brightness of his glory and express image of his person, upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had by himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. We're writing about Christ. We're speaking about the one who is now the one by whom God is going to address humanity. And the writer says that Christ, by himself, purged our sins. Now, you start reading a book of the New Testament and you start reading about someone's sins having been purged, and it's talking about the readers, and guess what conclusion you draw? They're Christians. For the writer wouldn't have written to them of their sins having been purged, past tense, if they weren't Christians. But notice also chapter 10, verse 25, a passage that we're familiar with. Chapter 10, verse 25, not forsaking the assembling of, notice the term, ourselves together. He includes himself and he includes the readers within that category of those Christians who assembled together. And he says you're not supposed to be forsaking that assembling of one another as Christians. So, we can see very clearly, and there's many other indications to point to it, but we can see very clearly that, number one, these readers were Christians. Number two, ethnically, they were Jewish, not Gentile, as is indicated by the following evidence. Number one, the title of the book, originally. Now, you will notice that in some translations, for instance, the King James, I believe, actually, by the time it was translated, it said the Epistle of Paul to the Hebrews. That's not originally, that wasn't on the original manuscript. That was added by scribes and by people based upon their understanding of the book as time went on. But the original title of the book, close as we can get to it, and obviously recognizing there probably wasn't a title on the original manuscript, but the earliest reference title to it is to the Hebrews. Well, who are Hebrews? They are Jews. Jews fall under the class of Hebrews. Who else falls under the class historically? All right. First, who are Jews, based upon the term? God's chosen people from the perspective of those who inherited the covenant, yes. But from the perspective of the tribes of Israel. They're descendants of Abraham, but Jews are from what tribe? Judah. Okay? When you look at the transition of the terms throughout the Old Testament, you go back to Abraham and he was a Hebrew and his descendants were Hebrews. You get to Jacob when God changes his name to Israel, they're now known as Israelites. Sometimes they're still referenced as Hebrews because it's kind of like an outline. Main point one, Hebrews. Subpoint one, Israelites. Everybody that qualifies as an Israelite simultaneously qualifies as a Hebrew. You go down one step farther, for instance, down to the divided kingdom, when the Jeroboam and Rehoboam split the kingdom and the northern 10 tribes begin to be referenced now as Israel. And the southern tribes begin to be referenced as Judah. Okay? So everyone who's of Israel nationally is of Israel, Jacob, and simultaneously they're also Hebrews. Everyone who's from Judah is of Israel, Jacob, and is a Hebrew. You go down one step further, and the nation of Israel, the northern kingdoms, were destroyed by Assyria in 721 BC. And so when they're taken away, what remains? Judah and Benjamin, but Benjamin had basically been brought into Judah by that point. It was basically Judah, which is why they're referenced as Judah at that stage. So there's still basically two tribes, but they're all basically under the umbrella of Judah. Well, by the time they go into Babylonian captivity and then return, historically, they're known as Jews, which is a direct descendant of the term Judah. Okay? So the term Jews in the first century, while it may have ultimately included some of the northern 10 tribes, predominantly it is those who were descendants of the tribe of Judah. Okay? All that is to say this. The title is to the Hebrews. Strictly speaking, that could include descendants of Abraham who weren't Jews, because Abraham and all his descendants were Hebrews. But as it's used here, we're talking about descendants of Abraham who were under the law of Moses. So the broadest description we can give them by use of the term Hebrews is those who were originally Israel and Judah, the descendants of Jacob. Because no one else ever came under the purview of the law of Moses. So, it's written to the Hebrews, but these were Hebrews that had been under the law and were responsible to it. Notice also that they were Abraham's descendants. Chapter 2, verse 16. For indeed he does not give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. That's of no significance if they aren't descendants of Abraham, but in context, his point is God's been faithful to you all along. God's given aid to you all along, and he continues to do so through your high priest, Jesus Christ. Notice also that another indication of it being Jews that are being written to is the familiarity with the Old Testament sacrificial and priestly system characterized the readers. Also, the heroes of faith, Hebrews chapter 11, all of whom are Israelites. There were those who were involved in the Israelite nation and those who were the history of the Israelites, and therefore would have made an influence on the readers as Jews. Third thing that we understand, we learn about the readers from the historical allusions, is that the readers formed a definite community of believers. The significance of that is this. This isn't written to every Christian who was ever at one time under the Old Testament law. This is a letter based upon the statements that are made that is written to a specific group of people. Whether it be a church in a specific city, we're not told. But it's a definite group of people. Turn to chapter 13. It does not seem to be a general epistle directed to Christians at large, but rather the letter seems to be sent to a specific group to meet a specific need. Chapter 13, verse 24. Greet all those who rule over you and all the saints, those from Italy greet you. The idea of the readers forming a definite community is implied in several passages. Chapter 13, verse 24 would be one where the writer requests to the readers to greet all your leaders and all the saints. The language about leaders, past and present, would certainly indicate that a congregation is addressed. Other saints nearby who are to be greeted, chapter 13, verse 24, would indicate that it is a particular congregation rather than the church at large that is addressed. Chapter 13, verse 19 also states this, "But I especially urge you to do this, that I may be restored to you the sooner." The idea is the writer was desiring for them to remain faithful and that he could come visit them. Well, if he's writing to every Christian that's ever at one time was under the Old Testament law, therefore it's just a general letter written not to a specific congregation, the writer's not ever going to go visit every Jew that's now become a Christian. So that statement doesn't make sense unless he's writing to a specific group in a definite location. Notice fourthly, as we look at what we learn about the readers, is the community of Jewish Christians had some illustrious leaders in the past. Chapter 13, verse 7. He says, "Remember those who rule over you, who have spoken the word of God to you, whose faith follow, considering the outcome of their conduct." The indication seems to be that there are those who had been their leaders in the past, maybe elders in the congregation there, who had remained faithful, but the result had been martyrdom. It seems to be the idea of the passage that the outcome of their faith, they had remained faithful, but they had suffered as a result. He's telling them, you follow their example. You remain faithful as they have. You be willing to suffer as they have. What's the statement immediately following that? Chapter 6, 13, verse 8. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. What's the one preceding it? "So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?" Now, you sandwich, what shall I fear? What can man do to me? Because the Lord's my helper. In between Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever, a statement of his eternal nature, therefore his existence as God, and in between that you put discussion about their leaders in the past and the outcome of their faith. And it's very clear he's talking about those who have suffered death as a result of their stance as Christians. And so they were to remain faithful as their prior leaders, as those who they could remember had done. Number five, they were people for whom the Septuagint version was an authoritative Bible and who would not be offended by a letter addressed to them written in excellent Greek, which certainly could apply to the Jews in Palestine during that time period. Number six, for the readers, the gospel had been validated, corroborated, as God worked miracles through the apostles. Chapter 2. One of the verses we already read, chapter 2, verse 3 and verse 4. "How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard him? God also bearing witness, both with signs and wonders, with various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will." So, these individuals who are being written to are those who have witnessed the miracles. They've seen them firsthand. They've heard from the apostles' very lips the gospel and the testimony concerning Jesus Christ. They were ones who had had the gospel validated and corroborated by the apostles and by the miracles themselves. Notice also, number seven, that they had given practical evidence of their faith. Turn to chapter 6. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 10. "For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love which you have shown toward his name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister." These Christians were ones who had been active and are still active. I don't know what's going on there, but apparently it doesn't like me. They had been active. and they remain still active in serving and benefiting those who were suffering, whether because of a lack of money, whether because of circumstances, whether because of persecution. And there's even an indicator later on that they had helped the one who was writing them and had been of benefit to him in time past. So they were ones who had practical evidence and demonstration of their faith. These aren't brand new Christians who had just been converted, who had never actually been active. These were Christians who had had time to demonstrate in the past and in the present that they were willing to serve God. Chapter 10, verse 34. Chapter 10, verse 34. He says, "For you had compassion on me in my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and an enduring possession for yourselves in heaven." He says, you've been willing to give up of your physical possessions to the benefit of others. And the description is that you've been plundered. It's as if you had lost a battle, and the other army had come in and wiped out everything you had. Except what had they done? They had offered it freely. They had taken that which they had, and they had been willing to offer it freely to those who were in need and to the author himself for their benefit and for the continuation of their ministry and their work and for their provision. And yet it was to the extent that it appeared as though they had been plundered. Okay? So these were Christians who were active in comforting those who had been harassed for their faith. Notice also that they're Christians who've been persecuted in the past. You go to chapter 10, this time verse 32. He says, "But recall the former days." So he's asking them to take their mind back to a previous time. "Recall the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings." These are Christians who are Jews who had suffered in the past, but now because of more suffering, they're thinking about turning back. They're thinking about going back to the old law. They're thinking about turning their back on Christ because of the suffering they're now enduring. And the writer says, "But you've gone through this before. Remember what you've endured before and take heart." Chapter 12, verse 4. He says, "You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin." He says, you've suffered in the past. You've been persecuted. You've endured these sufferings, but you personally haven't yet lost any blood over it. You personally haven't yet had your blood shed in your struggle against sin. But the persecution that was ramping up, the persecution that was coming, was beginning to cause them to rethink their decision and causing them to consider maybe turning their back. Notice number 9, that they are now facing a new opposition. The current wave of opposition seems to have been caused. Excuse me. Let me reread this and put the words where they belong. This current wave of opposition has caused many to consider quitting Christianity in favor of returning to the old religion. Some have already stopped attending the assembly, chapter 10, verse 25. The opposition was so persuasive that it seemed the obvious thing to do was to change religions and no longer be the object of the persecution. Now, what we don't have in the book of Hebrews is an explanation as to where the persecution is coming from. We don't know if, as he's writing to these Jewish Christians, it's the Jews who are going to be persecuting them. We don't know if it's the government that's going to be persecuting. We don't know if it's Rome that's going to be persecuting. There's no indication of it one way or another. But we do know they were headed towards persecution. And they were enduring things at the present time that was making them rethink their devotion to Christ. Number 10, we know that they knew Timothy and the writer. Chapter 13, verse 19, which we already read, that spoke concerning Timothy. But I especially urge you to do this. That they knew that this speaks concerning the fact that they knew the writer, that I may be restored to you the sooner. Indicates he had been there with them in the past. They knew who he was, and he desired to be restored back to them. And then chapter 13, verse 23, know that our brother Timothy has been set free, of whom I shall see you if he comes shortly, or with whom I shall see you. So it was someone who they knew that was writing to them, and they knew Timothy as well, and anticipated both Timothy and the writer coming and visiting them. Number 11, that we know that they found something very attractive in the old Jewish religion. Attractive enough to give serious thought as to rejoining its devotion. In this devotion, something similar to what we read about in the Christians at Jerusalem, Acts chapter 21, verse 20, where James says to Paul, you remember Paul's been away on his third missionary journey. He comes back to Jerusalem, and James, the apostle, by all indication, the elder of the church of Jerusalem, who was also the half-brother of Jesus, comes to Paul and says, you see, brother, how many thousands, tens of thousands, there are among the Jews who are those who have believed and are all zealous for the law. If following Christ brought persecution, the older way of the Jewish practice did not, why not return to the old religion of religion after all that was divinely given? And that's their mindset. Well, God gave this one to begin with. Why not just go back to it? If it was given by God, it's not like it's pagan. You know, it's not like we're going to idolatry. We're just returning to another religion that God gave to begin with. So why not just go back to it if we don't get dead as a result of remaining as Christians? Number 12, while at first sight it is attractive to go back to the old law, such a return was fraught with problems. And here's where you're going to begin to get into the depth of what the message of the book is. Chapter 13, verse 14. That's a 5-minute bell, right? Okay. Chapter 13, verse 14. Good, it means I'll actually get done. Woo-hoo! He says, for we have here no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. Now, you go back to chapter 11, and you read about Abraham, who searched for a city whose foundations and builder was God. He anticipated a promise that he never received in this physical life because he was anticipating a promise that wasn't physical. He was anticipating one who was going to come who wasn't physical. He was looking forward to a city built by God. Well, now you have these Christians, these Jewish Christians, who are turning back to Jerusalem. They're turning back to the city of God in the past. They're turning back away from the new Jerusalem that we read about in Revelation. And I believe as well Peter references it in 2 Peter chapter 3. They're turning their back on the new Jerusalem. They're turning back to the old city. He says, we have no continuing city here. We have no continuing dwelling place like Jerusalem where it's the city of God anymore. We look for a new city. So if they turn their back on the religion, they turn back to a city, Jerusalem, that's about to be destroyed. Because based upon all indication, the writing of the book takes place after Jesus' ministry, because it references that being testified by others, during the time of the church, but before Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. So sometime between AD 33 and AD 70 is when the book's written. We can't be a great deal more definite than that, other than it seems fairly close to that time when when Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. Notice also that they would be going back to a sacrificial system that never could take away sins and to a religious ritual that was about to be ended by force. Chapter 8, verse 13. Chapter 8, verse 13, we read, in that he says a new covenant. So he's talking about the new covenant, the new testament. He says he has made the first obsolete, the old covenant, the covenant with Abraham, the covenant with Israel. He's made the old obsolete. That now what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. You were going to see, and these individuals were going to see in their lifetime, the end of the Jewish system. And not in the sense that God was still condoning the Jewish system. But when Rome came in and destroyed Jerusalem and they destroyed the temple, they not only destroyed the place where the Jews worshipped, but they destroyed the ability of the Jews to worship. Because they destroyed all records of the genealogies of the Jews. And you cannot have a Jewish system of worship until you can prove that you're a descendant of Aaron. Why? Because you had to be a descendant of Aaron to be a high priest. And without a high priest, no one could make that offering of atonement. No one could enter into the Holy of Holies. Oh, you could build another temple. You could build another tabernacle. But when the confirmation and the ability to know whether or not you were of a certain tribe and whether or not you could be a priest, when that went away, the system went away. The Jews cannot, even today, the Jews cannot worship in accordance with the Old Testament law. Because there's not a one of them that can confirm by testimony and by evidence that he is of the tribe of Levi or Judah, let alone the descendant of Aaron. Can't have a high priest. Alright? Notice also that worse than that, such a defection from Christianity would be tantamount to falling away from the living God. Chapter 3, verse 12. Falling away from their Christian faith altogether. The writer identifies that they were in danger of drifting away, chapter 2, verse 1. And he indicates that the real cause was found in chapter 3, verse 12, in unbelief. Now, chapter 10. I want to mention this one passage before we close. Chapter 10. He says, verse 26, "For if we sin willfully, after we have received the knowledge of the truth and have no longer remained, and there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but certainly fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation which will devour the adversaries, anyone who has rejected Moses' law dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of how much worse punishment do you suppose will he be thought worthy who has trampled the Son of God underfoot? And which has done despite under the blood of, the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and thought it an unholy thing." When you look at what these Jews were contemplating, he says, "You're taking it upon yourself to turn your back on Christ and to act as if his blood means nothing." He says, "You're acting as though it is that which is just refuse in the street that you walk on." When you turn your back on Christ, when you turn your back on the covenant, when you turn back to a different way of doing things, the writer says you have insulted the Spirit of God. You consider that which is holy as that which is common. And you have trodden underfoot the Son of God. Let us be mindful of the admonitions to the Hebrews as we go through this book. You're dismissed.